Welcome to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. I want to share a story with you this week about... It's about a lot of stuff. It's about a guy on a quest to understand his family tree. It's about how stories can turn into maps. It's about what can happen when you decide to do something unpredictable. It's about a long walk, crazy train ride, historical reenactors, and Oprah Winfrey makes an appearance in this story at one point, honest to God. There is a lot that happens. Let's just put it that way. But what the story is about, for starters, is this guy, an African-American guy with a Jewish name. I met him at his house in Brookville, Maryland.
My name is Anthony Cohen, and I am a historian of African-American history and slavery. And my path to the work I do actually came from my search, trying to find the origins of my family name and background. Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, you know, I'm from the Jewish priests, so to speak, but probably don't look like one. And all my life growing up, I had wondered where we got this name. And so in 1989, I asked my grandfather, who's also African-American, about the origins. And he said that his father, my great-grandfather, had been born free black in Philadelphia, orphaned and then adopted by a Jewish family from Wilmington, Delaware. And as I say, I you know, heard the Roots theme music in my head, and I was going to have my Kunta Kinte moment and go and search, you know, for this this family, which I attempted to do, but was never able to document the name. So it still remains a mystery.
For as little luck as he had tracing the lineage of his adoptive Jewish family, Anthony had an even harder time tracking down the family tree of his ancestors of African heritage. He says for most Americans of African descent, people who've been here since the time of slavery, the Civil War and the 1870 census is about as far back as you can get. Well, Anthony went on to study history at American University, and for one of the classes he took, his assignment was to document a part of history that had gone unrecorded. He chose the Underground Railroad, and he started collecting oral histories from people, people who told him tales of their connections to previously undocumented points along the secret path to freedom. Anthony started plotting these points on a map, and distinct trails began to appear. And then he was struck with an idea.
What would happen if I just took the summer off and walked one of these routes I had documented? And so I cobbled together a general route that would take me through Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York, crossing over to into Canada along the Niagara River. And then I used some of the really deep research from my college paper about the specific roads in our area that I would be able to start off on. And the idea was, if I followed a road out of my county, it would lead to another county, and I could do similar research there as I went along, asking people what they knew about their local history, and hopefully lead me from place to place in a similar fashion.
So he did it. He put a change of clothes and some food in a backpack, and he started hiking. He says he set out with the mentality of the conquering historian. He was going to collect a definitive archive of oral histories along the way. But the trip started having a weird psychological effect on him, an emotional toll, you could say. And the longer he hiked along, retracing the footsteps of runaway slaves, the more he felt like he was not so much being haunted, but experiencing glimmers of what it must have been like to be them.
In fact, every day, almost any hour of the day, the past and present were being just constantly remixed. I mean, yes, I was following 18th and 19th century roads that we still use today, some isolated as they were then, but all certainly paved. But, you know, going through rural areas, there are no sidewalks on these roads. So the farms and properties that abut these roads have no fences. And therefore, when you're walking, dogs appear out of nowhere. They'll chase you. They'll stand in your way. You know, they prevented me from advancing at sometimes, and I had to reroute and go the opposite way around a town to avoid a fight with a dog.
I wonder if you might talk about your part of your journey that you made by train, I guess we could say. I'll leave the rest to you, the rest of this story.
Yes. About 10 days into the walk, when I had reached Philadelphia, I had spoken to a group of fifth graders at a Quaker school who asked me, what did I feel like? Could I share with them what it was like to actually be a slave on the Underground Railroad? And I had to explain that I wasn't, and that was, you know, a century and a half ago. But it gave me a thought and kind of put in my mind that here I was, you know, looking for the physical Underground Railroad, but that emotional journey was something that I hadn't even thought of tapping into. And during the Underground Railroad, Philadelphia was one of the main stations and well known for these great escapes, including one by a man named Henry Box Brown, slave from Virginia, who was shipped north in a crate, 26 hours to freedom.
He shipped himself?
Yes, with the assistance of a white friend of his, a shoemaker in Richmond named Smith. They put him in a crate. He was then conveyed by a wagon, boat, and train, pinioned in this box of sorts. And I had this realization that maybe that was the way that I could get close to the slave experience. I also knew pitching this to Amtrak probably wouldn't go over so well. So
yeah, this was going to have to be sort of a guerrilla operation.
Exactly, which was perfect because that added the possibility of another element. When the fugitives escaped, they were breaking the law, and they could be punished and sent back by full force of the law. But here I was, a historian, free to go wherever I wanted. And I thought, well, if I were to get in a crate, have myself smuggled on this train, of course, I need to use accomplices. We would all be guilty of one or more state or federal crimes being on a Amtrak right of way. And I figured that would give us a hint, an aroma of the illegal and clandestine aspect of an escape. And so we built a crate.
So tell me what happened next. You get in this crate, and then what, I mean, can you see out of the crate? What do you feel? I mean, how long is it? What's the temperature? What was the experience?
First of all, it was nothing that we planned for or anticipated. I traveled, I believe it was May 17th, 1996, and I believe it was a Sunday. And so the day before, when we had constructed this box, which was 24 inches wide, 28 inches tall by 30 inches. And so it gave me enough room to sit in the box with my legs pressed up against my chest. And inside the crate, I could see where little fissures of light were coming through the walls, where the walls had been paneled. But I couldn't see outside of the crate. And one of the faces of the box was actually a trap door on hinges. On the outside, it looked like it was a fully contained box. But from the inside, there was a latch, and I could get out of the box if I chose to. We traveled that day, and I remember getting to the train station at 11 in the morning, and the temperature was already 89 degrees. It was the first day of a three-day heat wave. By the time I reached New York, it was 99 degrees. And the temperature in the box was probably about 4 degrees warmer than the outside temperature because of my body heat. So all during the journey, you know, I'm sweating. I managed to get off all of my clothes except my boxer shorts. And then maybe every 20 minutes, because of whether relative humidity or if it was my own perspiration, but every 20 minutes or so, a drop of liquid would form on the screw plates, which held the roof to the frame of the crate, and fall into the chamber. So it was like the box was sweating alongside me during the whole journey.
And this journey took how many hours?
Well, it was supposed to take 2 hours, but we missed the first train. I had to be in the box on a platform for several hours. And then finally, after reaching New York, the total time was 6.5 hours from entering the box to exiting.
And obviously, when you were getting loaded and unloaded, you were being hoisted in there by people who were totally unaware of what the contents of this box was.
Correct. You know, we were very proud of ourselves with the whole trapdoor notion that once I was on the train, I'd be able to use this trapdoor to get out. I was going to be placed on a freight car, so I knew I would be there alone, and then just return to the box before the train arrived in New York. But in order for them to actually put the box onto the car, it had to be on a pallet. In order for the box to be attached to the pallet, they ringed it with ropes so that a forklift could lift up the pallet and place me on board. So once on the train and the train starts to move, I go for the trap door, and that's when I discovered that it won't open because ropes are going across it. So all the time when I'm on the train, I'm having this panic moment because with each stop the train made, workers would get on with more baggage. And at one time, I believe it was probably Camden, New Jersey, one of the first stops, not only did baggage handlers get on the freight car, but they stayed on the car and went to the next stop, sitting on my crate. And that's when I got some of the best reconnaissance of what I think the mindset of Henry must have been like then. Because while the people were sitting on my box, all I could think is, you know, don't burp, stomach, don't grumble. And I went into survival mode. So I didn't feel the heat. I didn't feel the lack of air. I was only honed in on survival. And it made me realize that adrenaline was probably the main fuel used on the Underground Railroad.
And just focusing on that moment when you could get out of that box. What was that moment like? So six and a half hours later, you get unloaded from this train. You have some other friends waiting there to meet you. What was it like when the lid opened up?
When they got there, they couldn't find the box. So they had to search all the cars, and the wrong shipping label had been put on the box. But they did get me out of the station, Penn Station in New York City. And anyone who's ever been there knows Madison Square Garden is right across the street. It being a Sunday, I think there was a game or something at the venue. And so they had cordoned off all the surrounding streets so that once the venue emptied, people could get to the train and the subway station without hindering traffic. And it was at that moment that my friends placed me on the street, you know, whispered to me that I was a free man and that I was I could emerge. And so I remember unlocking the trap door, pushing it open, crawling out, raising my fist to the sky. And as soon as that happened, the doors to Madison Square Garden fly open. Hundreds of people poured out of the venue around me. And I don't think they even noticed that there was a half-naked guy, you know, standing next to a crate. They probably thought I lived, you know, I was homeless and lived in it. So that was an interesting coda to the journey.
Another one of those surreal moments of cognitive dissonance, past and present.
Absolutely. And I'm guessing it was similar for them as well. People who were enslaved through culture, through religion, through song, always had a reference to another place. Canaan was the psychological manifestation of it. And on the Underground Railroad, Canaan was Canada. It was actually a code word for Canada. But to actually get to a place, terra firma, that meant freedom, must have been mind-blowing. At the same time, what I learned was here I was in 1996. I think I was 32 at the time. And I had been to most of the states in the Union by that age. But when I was on the road, the further I got away from home, the more homesick and forlorn I got. Even though, this was a project that I was doing by my own choice. And so I think that the Underground Railroad was actually a bittersweet railroad. It could take you to this place of freedom, but it stripped you of everything you had ever known before.
Historian Anthony Cohen talking about his experiences retracing the routes of those who escaped north to freedom on the Underground Railroad. His unorthodox train trip in 1996 got the attention of the press at the time, including a media mogul who was about to take on the role of a former slave in a new movie based on Toni Morrison's novel, Beloved. We're going to hear what happened when those two crossed paths right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Aaron Henkin. If you're just joining us, we're hearing the story of Anthony Cohen. He's an historian who figured out how to map the routes of the Underground Railroad. And then he proceeded to hike those routes, retracing the steps of escaped slaves, making a break for freedom to the north. At one point, Anthony squeezed himself into a crate and had his friends covertly load him onto a train from Philadelphia to New York City. He wanted to get a sense of the experience of Henry Box Brown, who mailed himself to freedom. Anthony's train trip happened in 1996, caught the attention of talk show phenomenon Oprah Winfrey. She invited him onto her show, and he impressed her. And afterwards, she asked him a question privately. It was a request, actually. She explained that she was about to star in a movie adaptation of Toni Morrison's novel Beloved. She'd be starring in the role of the former slave Setha. And so to prepare for the role, she said she wanted to do something to really understand her character. She was looking for some kind of immersion experience, something like Anthony's train trip in a box. And did he think he could help her really get inside the mind of an enslaved person? She was open to any ideas he might have.
And so I kind of threw out the craziest idea that I had. And that was, what if we bring you, Oprah, to Maryland, to an old plantation, will blindfold you, transport you there, change you into slave clothing. And when the blindfold comes off, it'll be the year 1850, and you'll have to live and work on this plantation as though you were an enslaved person of the time. You'll interact with people who will be portraying the people of the time. And you'll either spend the whole 48 hours enslaved, or if you make your connection, you'll be able to escape on a simulated Underground Railroad.
As you say, there are these reenactors. There are white reenactors and black reenactors, and some of them are instructed to be friendly to the cause of the Underground Railroad, and some are not. And so it's her job to sort of show up, have this blindfold removed, and then see what she can make happen next.
Exactly. Our interpreters, as we referred to them, were, yes, half black. Half of them were white, and in each of those groups, half of the white interpreters were friends, half were foes. The same for the black interpreters. And so she had to suss out through her interactions with these people which side they were on. Then, of course, the grand prize is you make your connection, you get to escape to freedom. Well, what is freedom? We cobbled together a 12-mile swath through northeastern Montgomery County, over fields, stream valleys, the small swamp or two, where we could move her over that 48-hour period where she would never see a telephone pole, a paved road, or anything from the modern era, which in modern Montgomery County is quite a feat. And then we had planned to just throw all this stuff at her. I brought down a guy from Frostburg, Maryland, with his bloodhounds to hunt her down in the woods at night. She would have to sleep the first night in a cave, second night in the loft of a barn. But we told her none of this. We just told her she would have an experience on a plantation because we wanted whatever encounter, interaction, reaction to be as raw and guttural as possible.
And so how did that end up for her?
First of all, Oprah was unbelievably open and embracing of the opportunity. And she did everything we asked of her. She did say later that even being blindfolded and put through the activity, which we called the regression, which I can't describe to you. It's our secret sauce, but it's basically a historical hazing that takes the person from the present into the past. And she later commented that when the blindfold came off, she said, we could have just done that and it would have been enough. And so she made it through the first day and then had an emotional collapse and an epiphany. And that was, as she described it later, the realization of the sacrifice that her forebears made so that future generations could thrive and so that she could be Oprah Winfrey today.
This was a hugely transformative experience for her. She said at one point, this is too real.
Yes, yes. And I don't think that was the response that we were fishing for when we were putting this together, but it was certainly the right answer. And Life is Strange. And as she began speaking about this experience, I started getting calls from people saying, hey, how do I get this slavery immersion experience? To which I usually said, are you crazy? you want to experience slavery? And people kept saying, you know, I got a guy from Microsoft who said, I would like to put, you know, my mid-level managers through your experience instead of sending them to diversity training. I think they would get more out of it. And people kind of verbalizing their take on what they were hearing Oprah say as being this incredibly transformative experience and one of self-emancipation.
You're tuned to The Signal on WIPR. I'm Aaron Henkin. Historian Anthony Brown took that momentum, that rising tide of curiosity and the cultural friction that went with it, as an opportunity to get organized. And in 1999, he formed a nonprofit called Monair. That term, by the way, is an expression that people used as a passcode on the Underground Railroad. And Anthony bought a farm, the Button Farm. Since then, he's operated this place as a living history destination, a destination that's unlike anywhere else in the country.
The Button Farm, now called the Button Farm Living History Center, is a 40-acre working farm in Germantown, Maryland, that's run by the Monair Foundation, which is my nonprofit. And we are nestled in a 6,000-acre park, Seneca Creek State Park, and we replicate plantation life, day-to-day plantation life. So if your listeners have ever been to Colonial Williamsburg or Sturbridge Village, they'll know the general idea of a living history center, where we have interpreters who portray the past. Different from those locations, we don't do first-person interpretation where, you know, someone pretends it's, you know, 1 year in time and they talk in old-timey speak and say, what is that strange device that you have plugged into your ear and stuff like that. When people come to our farm, we have basically removed the wall or the veil between the visitor experience and the interpreter. So for our school programs, the bus pulls up, kids get off the bus, we put hose in their hands, and we put them in the fields working. And it's their experience and their retelling of their experience to us, which illuminates what slavery was like. On this farm, we grow the crops that were grown in Maryland at the time. We have the heritage breed animals that were here during the time. And so that what you see, taste, hear, touch, smell, is all an authentic 1850s experience. And then once through the immersion, hopefully the person has gained an experience that will allow them to, you know, confront what enslaves them in their own lives.
Anthony Cohen, I think about this place and this experience that you create, and it seems also like you've got your hands on this intensity of reality dial that you're, you know, turning up to an appropriate level at the Button Farm, and that you're choosing on occasions to turn up to more controversial levels, like the work that you did with Oprah Winfrey and that immersion experience, and the historical demonstration that you did at one point of recreating a slave auction, or your idea to have a slave collar made for yourself by a blacksmith, and pushing these hot buttons. And everybody who becomes a part of that project or that prospective project is part of that uncomfortableness. And that seems like part of the purpose as well.
It is. I think confronting the past is part of our mission. One never knows what emotion is going to appear in encountering the past. And there's no right answer. You know, I've had African Americans come and try on the slave collar and spontaneously break down and apologize for slavery, which you would think would be strange because people of African descent were enslaved. But emotions emerge in very strange ways. I always ask for a volunteer when I have a group and I have the slave collar. Anybody wish to try it on? You know, 9 times out of 10, it's a hands of white visitors that go up first. I mean, one of the things I always ask our school groups when the kids are there, you know, they've gone and they've done their plantation chores, and we do a simulation, though that's not the right word, but of the auction block with the kids. They stand on a crate and we take them through all the steps that would have happened on an auction. It's not a dramatic rendering. They're not bought or sold. But they see the elements that were at place and they get to speak about those. Then we'll usually take one of their teachers, ask for a volunteer and get one of their teachers in the slave collar, which can be very a poignant moment. But then my last question to them always is, okay, you know, you've experienced the past. You know what life was like 150 years ago. You've got a hint, an aroma, a taste, a scent of it. Tell me, what are people 150 years from now going to judge us for? And these kids, there isn't even a half breath between the question and the answers that they start shouting out. And they're talking about women's rights and modern slavery and economic justice and food justice and gay rights. They know the things in their own world that are the struggles. And so they see themselves clearly in that bigger, wider scope of history. And that's what we want. And that's what our programs were inspired to do.
Historian Anthony Cohen, reflecting on the experiences of visitors to the Button Farm Living History Center. You can learn more about the place online at buttonfarm.org.